Hello, I'm Theo, and I was the Member of Parliament for Stafford and chaired the UK Birth Trauma Inquiry in Parliament. And I have a beautiful daughter, but like many women, my birth was far from straightforward. I suffered from a traumatic birth after a 40-hour labour, postpartum hemorrhage, emergency surgery for my birth injury, and went on to develop PTSD. And it was this experience that led me to start campaigning nationally on ending the postcode lottery in maternity care. So Breaking the Taboo is a new podcast on women's health. And in series one, I'll be looking at the issue of birth trauma by speaking to affected mums and their families, healthcare professionals and campaigners. So if you, like me, feel like you didn't know where to ask for help, or you felt too ashamed to ask, then I hope you know you're not alone and that this podcast is very much here for you. Please get in touch with us with your stories and your reflections on the show, as we'd love to hear from you. And thanks to our sponsor, the law firm Irwin Mitchell. You can follow me on Instagram at TheoClarkMP, or do get in touch with us via our show website, which you'll find in the notes below. And now on to today's show. Well, hello and welcome to Breaking the Taboo. And on today's show, we're going to have a special episode looking at maternal mental health. And this is something that's come up in a number of previous episodes where affected mothers and families have been talking about the impact on their psychological state. So I'm delighted to have with us two expert guests today. And the first is Dr. Rebecca Moore, who is a consultant perinatal psychiatrist who's passionate about trauma-informed care and reducing trauma in maternity care. She's the co-founder of Make Birth Better, which is a UK-based collaboration of parents and professionals educating and campaigning around birth trauma. And she's also a mum. And I also have with me Rachel McGrath, who is the chair of the Birth Trauma Association. But she came to the role having access support herself from the BTA due to her own traumatic childbirth, which resulted in serious physical and psychological injuries. And Rachel has also worked for the Regional NHS Service for Maternal and Perinatal Mental Health. And she has twins, something I'm sure we'll get on to talk about today. And she's passionate about improving patient experience and embedding trauma-informed care into healthcare. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today for this show. And I can't tell you how many comments I've received from listeners asking me to talk about this subject. And it's something that is really clearly affecting families across the UK and around the world. So, Rebecca, if I could start with you. Firstly, for listeners who are less aware of the term birth trauma, could you just explain what it is?
Yes, of course. So when we talk about birth trauma, or actually really increasingly we talk about perinatal trauma, we're thinking about something that's happened to someone. It might be one event or a series of events in pregnancy, in their labour or postnatally, that has caused them significant emotional distress and harm. And there are lots and lots of things that can cause birth trauma, but we know why it's so important is that we have lots of statistics showing us that this is happening for one in three women and birthing people in the UK every year. So this is affecting lots and lots of people every single year. And that's why I'm so grateful to be talking about it here today.
And I think it's so important that we are talking about it. I mean, the whole purpose of this show is to break the taboo and hopefully the stigma about speaking about birth trauma. So, Rachel, if you're happy to share, then could you tell listeners a bit about your personal experience of when you suffered birth trauma yourself and how it affected you psychologically?
Of course, thank you so much. My husband and I didn't realise we were prime candidates for birth trauma because we endured a 10-year journey to becoming parents. We tried for 3 years and then had 7 years of IVF before we finally, after multiple failures and multiple pregnancy losses, ended up with a twin pregnancy that progressed really well. And we couldn't believe it because we pushed ourselves to our physical, psychological, economic limits to get this far. And my husband always joked we got two for the price of one small country. But we got to 36 weeks and I felt absolutely dreadful. Called my midwife and she dismissed me and said, well, of course you're going to feel ill. You're at the end of a twin pregnancy. And that reassurance that she gave me, I took because I'm not medically trained. And to this day, I regret that because unfortunately I had preeclampsia. And so the following day, I went on to have a complete total placental abruption at home, which is a life-threatening condition where the placenta detaches from the uterine lining. So mother is unfortunately hemorrhaging and baby is being starved of oxygen. So I had an emergency C-section under very desperate circumstances and both twins required resuscitation. I went into multiple organ failure, had to be taken in various parts. We all went to different parts of the hospital. And it was a long, protracted journey to recovery. Things went very, very wrong in my postnatal care. And I was sent into what's called hospital at home for 6 months, where I had nurses attending to me twice daily and a vacuum in my abdomen. And it was really the worst possible introduction to motherhood. But I flew under the mental health radar for such a long time because I was in physical crisis. And it was only when months later that physical crisis abated and I had reached psychological crisis point that the cavalry then reined in because I had reached the point of I'm not sure what would have happened without the intervention of firstly the Birth Trauma Association and then a brilliant healthcare intervention too.
Well, firstly, Rachel, thank you so much for sharing your story. Feedback I've had from listeners is hearing other mothers who've had similar experiences to themselves helps them to feel not alone. So thank you very much for being so brave. And Rebecca, if we could just pick up on that, Rachel made a really important point that she was having such horrific physical issues that she had to deal with that the mental health was picked up later. So could we talk a bit about the types of symptoms that mothers might start exhibiting to show that their mental health's been affected by their birth?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole range of symptoms that people can have. And obviously each person will have a unique mix. But we look for a sort of four classical groups of symptoms that you might see with trauma. So the first is reliving, replaying your trauma. So you can't stop thinking about it. It's in your mind when you don't really want it to be there. And that might be in your thoughts. You might see it in your dreams. You might have kind of visual flashbacks. Or you might experience it as pain in your body, like your caesarean scar hurting, for example. Then we look for avoidance. So trauma has said to you something terrible has happened. And what people are left with is this sense of kind of being super vigilant. Like I need to make sure that that never happens again to me and or my family. So feeling on edge, checking for risks, not wanting to do anything that might be too risky, feeling jumpy, angry, on edge. Then with that, you also can get avoidance. So I don't want to talk about my birth. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to have sex because it reminds me of birth. I don't want to have another pregnancy ever again. I don't want to go for a dental appointment because it reminds me of the theatre lights. And then alongside that, you can get negative changes in mood. So feeling flat, feeling guilty, blaming yourself. I didn't give birth well enough. I didn't feed my baby well enough. So I think you can see that if you've got any or all of those symptoms, it's such an incredibly difficult place to also be trying to parent for the first time as well. And the other thing that is sort of common to Rachel's story as well is that sometimes these symptoms take time to evolve. So initially people can feel very numb or shocked. And sometimes birth trauma symptoms actually peak at around 6 to 12 months postnatal, which is, of course, a time where you've been discharged from midwifery care and might not be really having any ongoing reviews as well.
Well, related to so much of what you said there, Rebecca, myself as a mother who suffered from birth trauma. Rachel, some of those things that Rebecca described, you've also experienced. Would you mind sharing with us some of the symptoms that you had?
At my very worst, I felt like I was existing in the film. I don't know if you've seen it, Final Destination. I felt like we had cheated death, which we had. We'd been very lucky that we'd survived the abruption. But now I was imagining it was lurking around every corner and it was an inevitability. It was coming for us. And I had a rare visit with a friend, and my son picked up a tummy bug from her son. He was less than a year old at this point. And so I resolved that seeing people, he ended up in hospital briefly with dehydration. But in my head, I made the leap that seeing people and going out had led to him being hospitalised. So I resolved, well, we won't go out anymore. That then escalated. And I said, well, we won't go downstairs because the dog's downstairs. The dog is dirty. If I take the children downstairs, they're going to get sick and we'll end up back in hospital. That then escalated further. And this is when I began to really reach crisis point, because I said, if I take my eyes off the children to go to sleep, harm will beset them. They might die in the night. And because I then had approximately 5 baby monitors trained on each child, one attached to the nappy, apnea mats, videos, audio monitors, and I wasn't sleeping, I began to feel potentially like I was bordering on crisis/psychosis that I genuinely do feel. It was reaching that point. It just became simply unsustainable. And I would have a routine. And this is where the OCD, the perinatal OCD, came in. If I didn't do things in a certain routine, I always believed OCD was hand washing, light switching, checking locks. But if I didn't say things in my head in a certain way, the children were doomed in my thoughts. And it was such a devastatingly excruciating, unsustainable way to live. And it was in a really rare moment of clarity what I'd actually done, is because I thought death was inevitable, I'd written out my birth story and I was looking for somebody external to send it to, because I imagined we were all going to die. I didn't know how. But I sent it off to the Birth Trauma Association saying, you know, just so you're in the loop. And within 1 hour of sending that email, I received a very validating and wise response saying, you need help, you're not going to recover. Get help now, and supporting me whilst I did that.
And I think you're making a really important point there, Rachel, about reaching out to people and asking for help. And we'll get on a bit later into the type of support available to families. But Rebecca, those symptoms that Rachel was talking about there of the OCD, I mean, what should, you know, friends or family members who are worried about a mother exhibiting unusual behaviour be looking out for? And when should they be looking for external help?
Yeah, so I mean, I think obviously that's super helpful when we get feedback from family and relatives, because they know the person best. So I think there's lots of different things that you can look out for. If somebody's really withdrawn socially, they're not doing things that they would normally enjoy. Obviously, if people are talking about having feelings or thoughts to harm themselves, that would be something that we would want somebody to be seen immediately for. And it's really just a change in people's pattern of behaviour. So they might not be eating, they might not be sleeping, they might be incredibly angry all the time. They might have developed all these kind of routines to keep themselves safe. So, you know, the buying lots of baby monitors is really common. You know, often people will feel that they need to check baby repeatedly at night, or they can't let themselves go to sleep. They don't want anybody else to hold the baby. Some people do also check, like, locks, windows, doors. They can get very preoccupied about where their family are. If their husband is 5 minutes late home from work, they assume that he's been killed and are kind of calling them repeatedly. So this real kind of hypervigilance about safety. And, you know, sometimes people can very clearly describe how they're feeling. But for some people, it's really hard to voice how they're feeling, and they don't quite understand how they're feeling. And if you're a first-time mum, it's really difficult to tease out what's just being a first-time mum and being tired and this huge transition. So kind of collaborative evidence from families is super helpful. And it's really just looking for, this person that I know and love and know really, really well is different and has changed somehow and has all these new routines or behaviours. So then, you know, talking to somebody about that can be really helpful to kind of be a pathway to get support.
That's so helpful to have that information, Rebecca. And you know, what struck me reading comments from mothers who've written in to me about the show is people saying, well, I can't have PTSD because I'm a mum and I've not been in a conflict zone or serving in the armed forces. So could we just talk a bit more about what is post-traumatic stress disorder and how it can affect mothers who've been through a difficult birth, Rebecca?
Yeah, so I think that is one of the unique things about birth being a cause of PTSD, is that, you know, we can universally equate PTSD with war or violence or a terrible natural disaster. But of course, for many, many people, birth is not traumatic. It's wonderful. But PTSD is absolutely recognised by NICE, which is kind of the NHS gold standard, as being a cause of trauma. And really what we know is that each year, 30 to 40% of women will feel traumatised by their birth or their pregnancy or postnatally. And of that bigger group who have trauma symptoms, a smaller group will meet a clinical diagnosis of PTSD. So when I talked previously about those symptoms and we're looking for the full groups, to have PTSD, you need to have one or more of the symptoms in each four of those groups. And if you have all of those, we can say you have a clinical episode of post-traumatic stress disorder. But a much larger group of people might have two of those four symptoms and still be significantly affected, but not be clinically meeting the diagnosis for PTSD. And in reality, what I want is that anybody who has symptoms of trauma can access treatment and get support. So PTSD is really kind of, you're just having a full list of symptoms and then you fulfill that clinical diagnosis. But I work with and support many, many people who, whilst they don't have PTSD, are significantly traumatised by their birth.
Thank you for clarifying that. So, Rachel, you mentioned some of your symptoms of PTSD, but could we just roll back a bit and discover when was the moment that you realised that you needed to get help? Was it something that you decided for yourself? Was it something that others pointed out to you saying you needed help? So I think it's really helpful for listeners who are thinking that maybe they're exhibiting similar symptoms of you know, when they should ask for help.
I didn't want to be this mum. Ostensibly, all my dreams had come true. And if you look at social media, and this is why social media is such a dangerous thing, if you look at my social media pages from that time, it would appear that they had. We were in the house, but we were smiling in the house. And, you know, there was that moment of clarity when I knew that I needed help, when my son was wearing dungarees and they had a crocodile on the front, embroidered. And as I sat, I watched this crocodile track backwards and forwards. I thought, it's not right. That crocodile's embroidered. And I had this dichotomy of thought where I was thinking, I can see it moving, but I know it's still. What is wrong with me? I don't want to be like this. I desperately wanted to see people. I wanted to be that mum who was out there doing buggy fit, who was out there showing off the beautiful newborn babies. I wanted to look at them and not feel apathy or, on a bad day, contempt because they had desecrated my physical and psychological health. I wanted to be, and I hate the term normal, so typical. I wanted that typical mum experience, and I wasn't getting it. And I was aware that I was spiraling. And that moment the crocodile started to walk across my son's dungarees, I thought, you've got two to it. My husband has this incredibly pragmatic view to life. And he says, you've got two choices. We either get on with it or we fold. And for a long time, I folded. And fortunately, on that day, I was at my computer and I was able to just make that one single move.
And what was the first thing that you did, Rachel?
You called. Reliving my birth experience. And some information. I thought I was unusual. I thought nobody experiences this, especially having been congratulated and told how lucky we were. You all, you know, oh, well, you all survived. And I didn't feel lucky at all. I was sitting there plugged into the mains with a drain in my abdomen for months. I had two babies that were in and out of hospital on a bungee. And it just felt like, what am I not getting? Everybody else sees. Why am I such a failure as a mother? Firstly, I couldn't do the most primal thing that any other mother could do, which is reproduce naturally. Secondly, I couldn't feed my babies because I'd been given medication incompatible with breastfeeding. So that was never an option for me. And thirdly, I didn't really like them. And, you know, well, it was like this perfect storm of absolute spiraling down into birth trauma. And I didn't know. And it was only when it had reached crisis point. And I thought, there is no way out. And this is not normal. This isn't typical. This isn't how we're going to live, and there is only one ending to this, and it's not a happy one. But I thought, right, so I reached out.
Well, I think we're such an important message that we have on the show today is the importance of reaching out and asking for help. And I really related, Rachel, to what you were saying, because I think it was my husband who first noticed I was exhibiting very similar OCD symptoms to what you've described. And I'll be honest, I was really not a fan of reaching out to have therapy or to get mental health support. I thought it won't work for me, not something I've done before. Why bother? And it was really my husband who persuaded me that I really needed to have specialist mental health services. And actually, it did make a huge difference. So, Rebecca, could we talk through a bit about the type of support that is out there for mothers who are feeling similar to what Rachel's just described?
Yeah, so there is, you know, there has been an explosion of more trauma-focused supports, you know, across the last 5 years, which is great. I think just before we get to reaching out, you know, I think it's still very, very difficult for many women and birthing people to reach out. We know that 50% of people with a perinatal mental illness will never reach out for support. And there are many, many layers of stigma and kind of shame that prevent people from doing that. So alongside the kind of reaching out, I think I would always want to also encourage communities, families and professionals to support people in that, because sometimes people just can't do that on their own. For most people, it usually would be that they would go and see their GP or health visitor as a kind of gateway to onward referrals. And we also know that for some people, that's not necessarily always a good experience. It can be a great experience, but sometimes people can be misdiagnosed or silenced or dismissed. So, you know, we need to get better at training GPs and health visitors to recognise birth trauma as well. And then we have lots of different layers of services. So we have NHS talking therapies where they will prioritise new parents. You can self-refer. We have maternal mental health services, which are very much trauma-informed teams that support people after birth trauma and in subsequent pregnancies. And we have perinatal mental health teams who would probably see people with more severe presentations, perhaps with suicidality as well. And in terms of therapy, there are four different therapies that are most commonly used. We love an acronym in the NHS, so they all have different titles. So we have CBT, which is trauma-focused cognitive behavioural therapy. We have EMDR, which is the eye movement therapy that a lot of people have heard about now. We have narrative exposure therapy and prolonged exposure therapy, so NET and PET. And they are all different kinds of therapies that can be offered. It will vary depending on where you live. Some services offer one, some offer them all. And for most people, they would probably have a course of around 20-ish sessions, which would be weekly, which might be face-to-face or online. And they really work. That's the really good thing. These therapies are very well evidenced to treat trauma and PTSD. So I think if people can get to them, they can be really, really helpful for people. Alongside that, you might also have medication. And there are lots of other therapies that people can also use or choose, which I can talk about maybe a little bit later on as well.
That's incredibly helpful. And I'll make sure in the show notes that we add in a lot of links to useful services so that families can find that information.
Imagine being told your son would never be able to walk or talk. When we didn't know where to turn, Erwin Mitchell were there.
Our legal and financial experts understand the impact of a serious injury. We help our clients receive the best possible medical care, rehabilitation, and compensation.
My son is now 12. He can walk, he can talk, and he makes me so happy.
At Erwin Mitchell, we'll help you to imagine what's possible so nothing feels impossible. Authorised and regulated by the Solicitors Regulation Authority.
So, Rachel, Rebecca just talked there about the types of therapies on offer. What did you have, and what were the sort of techniques that you were taught that really helped you with your healing and recovery?
You know, I still implement them today, and we're nearly 12 years on, coming up on over a decade now. And I went to the GP when I had finally reached out, and I was lucky. I was met with absolute horror, you know, initial shock when I finally confessed what I was actually doing and thinking. And I came out with a prescription for antidepressants, and I had this stigma, the shame associated, which was so misplaced. So I didn't take them for a while. But even just driving home from that GP appointment, by the time I got home, I'd had a phone call that said, can we form what's called a TAF, which is a team around the family. Now, I didn't realise there are lots of safeguarding implications around a TAF. People think it's social service involvement. I will absolutely say there was a safeguarding assessment done, and then there was no social service involvement at all. It was the best thing that has ever been implemented. It was a coordinated means of people communicating, and it meant that the cavalry, there possibly should have been some more scheduling of care because I was inundated with visitors and people there to help me. But when I was on a waiting list waiting for therapy, a health visitor who was at this point visiting daily, they were so worried about me, shared with me, because I told her, no, I've not taken Citalopram that I've been prescribed. She shared with me, and this is healthcare at its absolute finest, that she was taking them for her depression. And she immediately broke down that stigma, that shame, and I took them that day. So the medication helped to balance me whilst I got to the top of the waiting list. And I had a course of what's, I think Dr. Rebecca's referred to as high intensity exposure therapy. And that involved going to, there were several trigger points in my birth and postnatal journey. One was when I heard a doctor say, she's not stable. She's not been stable for 3 minutes now. And apparently at that point, all hell broke loose in the theatre and resuscitation attempts were begun. That to me was a moment of trigger where I had to immerse, I had to sit with that thought of panic, knowing that I'm dying. And I had to sit with that thought at the forefront of my mind until my anxiety dropped from something like 40 or 50 down to below 5. And I remember every appointment I would wear a scarf because there were other parts of my journey that were deeply triggering like that, that were the worst parts that would set me into absolute panic. And I wore a scarf and I would cover my face with the scarf to sob into it whilst the anxiety abated. And eventually it's as though those thoughts, and I don't know if this is an appropriate term, so apologies. It's almost like I became used to them. They became just a bit boring, really. Oh, here we go again. And yet, 4 years later, I had to do another course. There was stress going on in my life. I deemed it like it was almost like a muscle that, you know, you have to keep exercising in order to keep a lid on that anxiety. So I had another course of the same type of therapy and it worked, an absolute treat. That isn't to say I won't always be a work in progress because certain things do still trigger me, but it really did. It was brilliant. And finding the right therapist was an absolute joy as well. There was one, and I didn't realize you can do this. I didn't get on with one. I just didn't click. I thought, I don't want to share my internet. I don't want to share my feelings with you. I don't want to share this heartache with you. And I sent an email and said, please, could I swap therapists? New therapist rang me in the week. And it was just, it was revelatory to somebody who had such misconstrued visions of what mental illness was, because we're all open and vulnerable to it. And I shouldn't have ever felt worried or ashamed.
Well, that's such an important point, Rachel, for us to make on the show, that I hope by us talking about it, we are breaking the stigma and saying that it's absolutely okay to ask for help. And a really important point to stress is that, you know, you and I have both had therapy to help us recover from our birth trauma, and it has helped. And we've had different types of therapy, but it's really, you know, made a huge difference to our kind of day-to-day life. Although I have to say, I don't know about you, Rachel, but I still get very triggered going back into a kind of medical environment when you're asked in for like a smear test, or even as Rebecca just described, going into the dentist. And you do get those flashbacks and you're reminded of being in theatre or during the hospital. So Rebecca, just to give mums really specific information, do they need to self-refer themselves to get access to mental health support on the NHS? Or is that something where they can have it in their local service provider, and, you know, they'll be given an expert through that? Just what's the process for them to access a service?
So it depends a little bit about where you live. So NHS Talking Therapies, you can self-refer online. So say you live in Bristol, you would just type into Google Bristol Talking Therapies, up it would pop, and you would just be able to self-refer. Some services, you need a referral from a GP. So perhaps more typically perinatal mental health services or maternal mental health services, but they are all very different, unfortunately, across the UK. So I think you just need to find, you know, you could certainly ask your health visitor or midwife or GP, and they will know whether you can self-refer or whether they will be able to make the referral for you as well.
And I could give you an example in the Midlands, you know, where I lived in Stafford. I was referred to a brilliant service called the Lotus Service, and that's who gave me access to mental health therapy for a long time after birth until I was feeling much better. And Rachel, we haven't talked much about having twins on top of everything that you've just described you went through, both for your physical and mental recovery. So what was that like, and how did your relationship with them improve once you started to get help? Because I've heard from so many families how their bonding with their baby was so affected by the symptoms that they had. So could you tell us a bit about that?
We have a brilliant picture of me holding my daughter for the first time, and this daughter that I wanted, dreamed of having all the past decade. And I'm just looking at her and she's late, and I'm not holding her, I'm just staring. And the first time I held my son 5 days later, that was an absolute unmitigated disaster, because I'd been given pain medication prior to it with the main symptom of vomiting side effects. So we won't touch on that. But it was just, I remember my husband saying to me, "Do you love them?" And I was in this hospital bed and I shrugged and I said, "Well, I don't really know them." I was, "Oh, well, of course I do. I do love them." But there was no bond. There was no rush of oxytocin. And when I got home, I was fiercely protected of them. I met their needs with every fibre in my being, but I didn't like them. And I remember dressing them and saying to my daughter, because she was crying, I remember saying to her, "A proper mum would know what was wrong with you." And I just didn't feel like, I felt so detached from them. And I didn't want them, but I couldn't bear the idea of anybody else touching them or taking, I just felt totally overwhelmed. And then when it got to 6 months and my C-section scar finally closed, skin was removed, and the physical crisis abated, children were fundamentally, they'd been started on weaning because they both had cow's milk protein intolerance. So they're little balls of vomiting red fury throughout weaning. And, you know, they vomited constantly. They screamed. It was sleep, vomit, scream. And I just remember thinking, I'm not a proper mum. And then they started to do much more interactive things. And I became less ambivalent towards them and completely obsessed with their well-being. And I desperately tried to make up for lost time. And again, it's only now that I realise you feel like you missed those first 3 days, because I didn't hold them for that time. But I now know, and Rebecca, please do correct me if I'm wrong, it's the first 1,001 days that's important in a child's life. And I was misinformed, thinking these first 3 days, I'll never bond with them. And I became absolutely over-attached to them. I wouldn't take my eyes off them, until eventually we found a happy medium. And then the challenge, because they became mobile, and so they would go in different directions, and I was still suffering with my health. And I would think, well, which one do I need to pick my favourite? Where do I go? And it was incredibly challenging, but there is a certain magic about having twins. And you do reach a point, it's possibly 3 glorious days, where they do occupy one another. My children are very gender typical. For a while, they both did ballet. I have boy girls. They both did ballet. They both did rugby, until they eventually settled in their gender stereotypical roles of ballet and rugby, football. But I just managed, and finding my community, I joined a twin club, because you go to a baby group and somebody will tap you on the shoulder and say, "Your son is climbing a ladder." And I'm thinking, well, my daughter is stealing somebody else's lunch. I can't. Whereas if you're with a twin club, they'll just haul that baby down for you, because they know the challenges that come with you. And finding that community, those 5 mums with twins, all of us who'd had various journeys to getting them, we all have various challenges. One of my children is neurodiverse with learning difficulties, and that became apparent at a very early age too. So that's been its own journey, and that's presented many challenges. But we all just mucked in, bonded, and we were there for one another. And that made the world of difference. And I think community and peer support is key.
And I completely agree with that. And you both obviously work with two fantastic different groups for people listening who've not heard of Make Birth Better or the Birth Trauma Association, two fantastic organisations in the UK. And I'll put the links into the show notes so that you can get access to support through both of them. And Rachel, you talked there about the stigma and the shame about you feeling like you weren't a good enough mother. And I just want us to touch on that because, you know, we use this phrase about being a good enough parent. And I think we kind of focus so much on looking after the baby that sometimes we forget to think about looking after the mother's physical and mental health as well. And, you know, you're trying to recover from major surgery and an incredibly distressing experience whilst also looking after newborn babies. And in your case, of course, twins. So Rebecca, if mums are listening who are feeling ashamed that they can't bond with their baby, they can't breastfeed, they can't do any of the things that they were expecting before they had their child, what advice would you give them? And what should they do in that scenario?
I think this is something that I see and hear all the time. And really, kind of after a traumatic birth, you almost get this kind of ripple of trauma afterwards. You know, it might be NICU, it might be you can't feed as you expected to. Trauma and a traumatic birth can really affect people's physical milk flow. You know, you might be physically too weak to be able to feed. So they're all different kind of layers of ongoing trauma for people. And I think particular to childbirth related PTSD, there's this huge amount of guilt and shame, and we're very critical of ourselves, of mothers and how we failed. So I think first of all is just normalizing that is something that lots of people feel. It's a really common experience to feel like that. Many people do. And I think coming back to your trauma, that nothing about your trauma is ever your fault. It's not something you've done wrong. It's something that has happened to you, that has been done to you. We haven't really talked about the causes of birth trauma, but you know, it's often that you've been felt unsafe, felt out of control, felt dismissed, that there's been an emergency, that there's been a physical health complication. There are lots and lots of ways that trauma can arise, but they are never, ever your fault. So hard as it is to kind of voice that, try to begin to think about how it's making you feel. Perhaps write it down if you can't speak it out yet. Sometimes people can't say it, but they can write it. You can write a letter in your mind to the midwife about how they made you feel, or the doctor about how they made you feel. Sometimes people do that and it's really cathartic just to put it all on paper. And then, you know, if it's something that's really sitting with you and causing you lots of distress, then it's trying to seek all those sources of support. I think peer support and online support can be really invaluable, because sometimes it's too frightening to think of coming to see a psychiatrist like me. It feels too big a leap, but you might have a conversation with somebody online or on a helpline. Like Pandas have an amazing helpline. The Birth Trauma Association run a Facebook group. You know, all these places where you might start to say, this is how I'm feeling. And somebody will be responding and saying, I felt like that too. And I'm 6 months down the line, 2 years down the line, and I'm okay. And this can happen for you too. And let's support each other. So the power of those kind of peer communities, I think, is just absolutely invaluable as well. Sometimes people, you know, won't want to go to mother and baby groups, for example, because they will invariably be asked, how was your birth? And they don't want to talk about it. Or after a loss, you know, how many children do you have? And people will say to me, how do I answer that? You know, do I say it or not say it? So these sort of online or specific trauma-informed spaces and communities are really, really invaluable.
That's such helpful advice. And I think it's important to remind listeners that, you know, it's never too late to ask for help. So it doesn't matter if you gave birth in the last few weeks or, you know, decades ago, there is always a way to get support. And I hope that this podcast is giving you a community and a feeling that you can ask for help. And we've talked a bit about the types of therapy. I mean, I myself had CBT and also the EMDR that you described, Rebecca. But I'll be honest, I've been very put off having another baby because of my own experience with birth trauma. And I've heard from so many other mothers that that's the same for them. Could we talk a bit about people thinking about their next pregnancy, particularly if they have suffered from baby loss or a very difficult delivery first time around, and they're very worried about what might happen if they have another child? Because I think it's really important that we have that discussion as well.
So it's understandably really, really challenging and anxiety provoking for people to think about having another birth experience. And that might be because of both psychological health and potentially impact on physical health injuries as well. There are actually lots and lots of things that you can do. And again, each trust will offer something slightly different. So, you know, I would recommend people to go and speak to an obstetrician, because if there's, say, been a hemorrhage, a bleed, you know, go and ask questions about how likely is that to happen again? What might that mean? What might we do differently? Take notes, record the conversation, go with somebody to support you, go in with a list of questions. You are absolutely entitled to have that kind of preconceptual consultation. The same goes for midwifery. You might also go in and say, what can happen differently? And I often ask people to think about what they don't want to happen again. So people will have specific things. It might be about their pain relief. It might be about the way they were spoken to. But what can you put in place for me to make this a different experience? For some people, it might be you go to a different trust, a different hospital. Some people will commonly want to have a planned cesarean, because it can enable people to feel very in control. You can have the date when you're going to give birth. You can do lots of things to make the cesarean much less medical, for example. Or sometimes people will want to give birth at home because they can't contemplate going into a hospital again. You might then look at the kind of emotional, psychological support that you need as well. So some of that might be from your partner. Sometimes your trauma might have been that you felt your partner didn't advocate for you as they should have done. So really talking about how I need you to support me. And if they can't, do I need a different birth partner? Might it be my sister or my mum or a friend? And then thinking about the psychological kind of impact. What do I need in terms of advocacy and support? So that might be a doula. It might be an independent midwife so I can have full continuity of care. It might be having more therapy all the way through my pregnancy and afterwards to hold me through that understandable anxiety. So really, really mapping out each part beforehand can really help people to finally think, you know what, I think I can do this. It is invariably still really challenging for people. Of course, it's going to be anxiety provoking. And sometimes people have completely lost trust in the NHS to care for them. But it can also be very healing for some people. They can have a wonderful next birth experience. So I think just make sure you've done all those different parts and really ask questions, and you know, then you've got all your information to make an informed choice that is going to be unique to you.
That's so helpful. And I think we should let listeners know, in case they've not had one, but you can also have a debrief at most hospitals. So for example, I had birth reflections and it was so helpful, you know, a couple of months later to go through my hospital notes and kind of understand with a proper timeline, you know, what happened, when was I given what drugs? Because I think, and Rachel will relate, you know, we're so out of it when you're kind of in labour and in extreme pain and you've probably had a lot of medication. And so it's very difficult to kind of remember exactly what happens at that time. And Rachel, is there any advice that you'd like to give mums who are worried about having their next baby but would like to have one?
I think it's probably worth noting as well that birth reflections, when done well, are really helpful. But when done badly, or the notes aren't reflective of what you recall about your experience, and sadly, that happens an awful lot, they can be re-traumatising. My recommendation would be refer to for a second pregnancy prior to this or during pregnancy if needs be. Refer to the specialist in NHS maternal mental health services. These are new services and they have gems. They're like pure solid gold, these women and gentlemen who work in these services. They are specialist perinatal mental health midwives, and they will advocate for you in this pregnancy. They will write a birth plan, or they'll give you a document. This is, and they will go through that with your new hospital team with you. Good one. It just sets out your stool, makes you realize what is important to you. And these people who do this, I believe every woman and birthing person should have access to a specialist perinatal mental health midwife, because I think we would see far less trauma if the work done around mental health following pregnancy and birth trauma was truly trauma-informed as these people carry out their practice.
Well, you've led me on very nicely, Rachel, to drop in about the UK Birth Trauma Inquiry, which I chaired in the UK Parliament. In fact, that was one of our recommendations to the government to roll out perinatal mental health services across the country to kind of end the postcode lottery and make sure that we're listening to mums. So a question I like to ask all of my guests on the show is, you know, imagine that the government was listening and the NHS, what would you like to see in improvements in maternity care to reduce birth trauma? And Rebecca, if I could start with you.
So I think for me, it's a big piece of the missing picture is antenatal education. I think it's been systemically decimated in most trusts, and most people actually now either pay for it privately. So there's a huge variability of what people are actually being told about birth. And I think we really need to have, if we could have these in-depth, meaningful discussions with women and birthing people and their partners prior to birth about consent, choice, advocacy, the risks of an induction, the risks of using forceps, talking about physical injuries that can occur, it would enable people to be able to make choices in the moment, you know, of what they do or do not want. But we also, you know, need to hear all the stories of birth. And I think at the moment, we don't really talk about it in enough detail because the narrative is it will scare people, which I completely disagree with. I think, you know, actually people afterwards, when they've been traumatized, say to me, I wish I knew that a forceps might mean this. I wish I knew that I had this placental issue and nobody had really spoken to me about it. So I think for me, it's about the reintroduction of proper antenatal discussions, preferably with a named midwife that you see all the way through your pregnancy, so that you can really ask those questions and feel safe to ask any question of them.
That's a great suggestion. And Rachel, what about you?
I would like to see trauma-informed care training rolled out to all healthcare professionals and implemented to in every genre of healthcare imaginable. It's a constant running theme for me. Every time I end up accessing healthcare, I come out feeling somehow upset or traumatized by what I've just either been told or the manner it's been said to me in.
Thank you. And just a final question for both of you is, I really want this show to be very practical, to give some advice and hope to families that have suffered from this too and want to have advice for their help and recovery. So Rachel, is there one thing that you'd like to signpost families listening to the show today too?
Absolutely. It's the Birth Trauma Association website and our social media. We offer peer support that comes in the form of email and telephone support. We run this incredible social media group, and there is an absolute wealth of information available on the website, including advice, stories, factual help, and I think it's really a one-stop shop for anybody who thinks they may have suffered birth trauma.
Thank you. And Rebecca, where would you like to send mums?
So yeah, I mean, similarly, also on our website at Make Birth Better, we have a huge amount of resources, but specifically for professionals as well as parents, because we have to think about the impact of trauma on professionals as well. And we also have a wonderful document that we've just collaborated on with Pandas, which people can print out and list all the experiences and symptoms that they might be feeling. There's one for mums and birthing people and one for partners that you can physically print out and look at all the things and take to a healthcare professional to begin that discussion and journey to treatment and recovery.
Well, thank you both so much for those really practical signposted resources. And all the links will be both on my website and in the show notes. And Rebecca, I'm pleased you mentioned about partners, because I've had a lot of emails and messages from fathers who've been writing into me and the show saying, Theo, when's our episode? Because we get affected too. So we are going to do a specific episode for dads and partners later in the show as well to get their perspective too. Well, can I thank both of the guests for coming on today on the show? I think it's so essential that we had this specialist discussion about the mental health side of families who've been affected by birth trauma. Know that you're not alone. Know that there is support and help out there. That's why I set up this show, was to be that community and that voice for you. And know that you can always ask for help. And if you've been enjoying the show, please do rate us in iTunes on Apple Podcasts, and make sure you share the links with friends, family and colleagues, so that we can reach and help as many affected families as possible. So thank you for joining us today, and tune in next week to the next episode of Breaking the Taboo. Thank you.